What might happen next in the presidential election? Looking at the law. As expected, the outcome of the presidential race was not known on election night, as voting officials in important swing states process a record number of mail-in ballots. Even before all those ballots have been counted, President Trump has declared he is taking the results of the election to the Supreme Court, insinuating that he will find instances of voter fraud that swing the election to him. All of this has people looking more closely at the 12th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the laws in individual states. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, two experts are with us to help us separate wild speculation from reality and understand the process of what legal steps could unfold next. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. So many questions remain in this aftermath of Election Day. Legal challenges to votes cast and not counted will likely dominate the news in the days ahead. Today, we'll talk about what the Constitution says about election law. My guest, Dimitri Baum, Vice Dean, Provost, and Professor of Law at the University of Maine School of Law, and Andrew Rudalevich, Chair of the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. We always invite your questions and comments. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. But first, briefly on the line with us now is Steve Missler, Maine Public's chief political correspondent. We've asked him to join us for a few minutes to give a recap of where things stand. And Steve, thank you so much for joining us. I know you have had quite the long night.
Yeah, so have you, though. So glad to be here.
Mine has not been as long as yours, Steve. Anyway, I want to ask you about the latest on the Senate race. Everybody expected this to go to a ranked choice vote, that they expected neither Susan Collins nor Sarah Gideon to get 50% of the vote. But it looks as though there's a chance Susan Collins will indeed get that. What do we know at this point?
Yes, you're right. It's very close at the moment. At the moment, Senator Collins is hovering right around 51% with about 85% of the precincts reporting. If you go over to the Bangor Daily News, there's about 93% of precincts reporting. And she's still right around that 50 plus one mark, which would, of course, preempt a ranked choice voting runoff. What I will say is that if for some reason, that changes and Senator Collins dips below the 50 plus 1%, and there is a runoff, it may be a formality, frankly, because it's not clear to me whether or not there's enough second choice rankings from either independent Lisa Savage or Max Lynn, the other independent in the race, that would actually go to Gideon, that would get her over the finish line. So very unclear at the moment, but what we can say with some certainty is that Senator Collins is in a very good position to secure a fifth term.
All right. We know that Shelley Pingree, as expected, has won the first congressional district. The second congressional district, Jared Golden was ahead in the polls, but the numbers look tight most of the evening. Is that race over?
Well, there have been some calls in it. The Associated Press has not done that quite yet, but that may be just a matter of time. He does have quite a lead there, and Dale Crafts, his Republican challenger, has conceded that it would be very difficult to overcome the deficit that he currently faces. So, that was the story of the night, I think, with a lot of the polls, where they just were not reflective of what happened, with the votes. So that's there's going to be a lot of perhaps another reckoning after we had one in 2016 about the polls. But that's where we stand at the moment.
All right. What do we know about the second district? Maine, one of few states that actually apportions its electoral college votes by district. The second district is close in that, too.
It is, although it looks like the president is poised to secure once again a single electoral vote in the second congressional district. The latest margins that I've seen is that he has a 7-point lead there. What's interesting about that is just the disparity between the first district and the second district. Joe Biden won the first district by 23 points, and he's down by 7 in the second congressional district. If you go back to 2017 or 2016, that was the difference between the two districts was 24 points. It's even wider now. It's 30 points. So once again, you know, we're looking at this big disparity between these two congressional districts, and that says a lot, I think, about Maine politics at the moment.
I want to ask you about the Maine legislature going into this election, both the House and Senate controlled by the Democrats, and every single member of the legislature on the ballot. This is not like the U.S. Senate with 6-year terms. What do we know?
Well, it looks like Democrats are in a good position. It may not be clinched quite yet, but it sure looks that way, of retaining full control of the legislature. A little bit interesting, though, because you know they ended up losing, it looks like, about 8 seats to Republicans in the House. And that, you know, while they will have, it looks like, 80 seats, Democrats, to Republicans 67, and that's a pretty decent result, except that they had a pretty big advantage going in. I mean, they had, I think it was between a dozen and 15 seats that were uncontested by Republicans. So they were already up there. So they lost several, at least 8 seats where they were where those seats were actually contested. So not necessarily a banner night for Democrats there, although in the Senate, the state Senate, which is always flippable every 2 years, it's always very close. And it appeared as though the Republicans were in a good position to maybe flip that chamber. That doesn't look like that's going to happen. They have the Democrats, it looks like, have a 22-13 advantage there in that chamber. And a couple of big upsets, including one in Lincoln County, where a freshman legislator defeated Chloe Maxman, defeated Dana Dow, who's the current Republican leader in the state Senate. So big win there, but there were a couple of losses for Democrats too. But turns out it'll be a wash, and they'll end up getting maybe one or two more seats than they currently have in that chamber.
Steve, what stood out to you from your perspective as a political reporter from last night?
Well, I think the big thing, especially as it relates to the Senate race, the U.S. Senate race, is that there's clearly limits on, you know, how much you can nationalize a race, especially when you have an incumbent like Senator Susan Collins. You know, if you go and you look at that contest, Sarah Gideon, the Democrat, repeatedly tried to nationalize that contest, make it about D.C. politics, make it about the president, and trying to handcuff Susan Collins to the president, who is, you know, deeply unpopular statewide, but not so much in the second congressional district. There's obviously there are limits to that kind of a strategy. And Collins, I think, ran maybe the smartest campaign and maybe the only campaign that she could have, which was to really localize the race, focus on her record, focus on what she's done for Mainers. And, you know, at the end of the day, that seems to have been the winning argument. The other thing that I will note about it, though, is that, you know, there was a lot, if you match up Senator Collins with the presidential race, it's clear that she outperformed Gideon outperformed the president all over the state, including in Democratic-leaning cities that Gideon really needed to run up the score to win this thing. But, you know, Collins was able to either win those districts, including Lewiston, which was a huge, huge win for her last night. She won that by 2 points, and that's, you know, whereas Vice President Biden carried it by double digits, and so did Jared Golden, the second congressional district Democrat. And then there were other places like Saco, Old Orchard Beach, York, where Gideon won, but it was only single-digit victories, whereas Biden carried those by as much as 20 or 30 points. So a lot of ticket splitters out there. So, and you know, despite all this talk about polarization, there are a lot of Maine voters who just, you know, went for Joe Biden, it appears, and also Senator Susan Collins.
Well, Steve, it's also interesting, and we could talk to you all day, but we have a really interesting program. So I want to thank you for a few minutes this morning, and I want to let our listeners know that there's so much reporting on MainePublic.org, including about those really interesting initiatives on the ballot in Portland. So, Steve, thank you. And to the rest of the listeners, please check out MainePublic.org and see some of the reporting there. Now to the topic of the day. Andrew, Dimitri, thank you both for being with us on Maine Calling again. And already the president says there is major fraud in the election and that we will be going to the Supreme Court. I'm going to start with you, Andrew. When you hear him say that, what is the first thing you think?
Well, as a an academic of a certain age, the first thing I think is about Florida in 2000 in the Bush v. Gore case. But actually, we're in a quite different position than that. And so my second thought is that there's no court case here, at least at the present time, right? We're waiting to count the votes, which is something people had predicted well before the election, right? That the election could be close, that it could come down to, you know, the extraordinary circumstances of this particular election where people needed to vote early, vote by mail, right? Avoid COVID crowds on election day. And so we are seeing that play out, right? A lot of the votes that have not been counted yet were cast quite some time ago. And so, you know, it's just a physical process of counting those votes. Now, it's possible there could be litigation that comes out of some of the decisions made. But, you know, nothing really starts at the Supreme Court. Anything that made its way through the court system would be quite limited, you know, to a single state, for one thing, and to a single rule, perhaps, that one side or the other thinks is problematic. So my reaction in the middle of the night was that, you know, the president needs a better understanding of how the court system works and how elections work. But I'm not sure that exactly was his aim in any case.
Yeah, Dimitri, I want to have you follow up on that. It's not as though the president of the United States can just walk over to the Supreme Court and say, hand me this election.
No, there's certainly a process, and I agree with Andrew. There isn't kind of a clear-cut case that we have in mind at this point. But I will say, you know, we leading up to the election, we already had a couple of cases, one from Wisconsin, one from Pennsylvania, reach the Supreme Court. So some issues have already been decided. And then obviously Pennsylvania is still one of the states that's out there. It could be determinative. And, you know, the Supreme Court has had a couple of chances at one of the cases that has to do with counting ballots that were postmarked before the election date but arrived late. I think there's a pretty good chance that that will go to the Supreme Court again, assuming, you know, that's outcome determinative. So there is a chance for that case to get to the court. So there is something in the pipeline. And then obviously we have no idea what's going to happen with some of the states that are very close. And so if you have recounts in those states, you know, as Andrew brought up, the Bush v. Gore scenario, right, that's kind of how it arose in that context as well. So who knows what will arise once the states start doing recounts if they're called for by the Republican Party.
Okay, so what you're saying is that if Pennsylvania ends up being the Florida of this election, the state that will determine the winner of the presidency, and if some mail-in ballots there are challenged, there is a chance that it could work its way up through the courts and end up in the Supreme Court. But there's a lot of ifs and maybes in that sentence.
Sure, yeah, but I would say there's a very good chance, if Pennsylvania is determinative, that that case would be back. You know, the court has had two shots to hear the case. Both times the court declined to overturn the state Supreme Court decision to allow the counting of late ballots. So the court hasn't spoken clearly yet, but Pennsylvania will be segregating those late arriving ballots. And there will be kind of a clear line to the court because they've already had that case twice.
All right. Andrew, let me ask you this. I've read and I've heard this phrase a few times now that armies of lawyers are descending on places like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania from both sides. What are the armies of lawyers doing right now?
Well, right now they're drinking a lot of coffee. They are trying to figure out what exactly is happening, right? We're watching the votes being counted. And so, you know, right now, ironically, actually, if President Trump got his wish and all votes were stopped from being counted from this moment on, you know, Joe Biden is in the lead in sufficient states to get him to 270 electoral votes. So clearly what the lawyers want on either side is for the votes that favor them to be counted and other votes to be set aside. And that's what they're looking for opportunities to do. Is there a legal basis for challenging a rule? The Pennsylvania case Dimitri mentioned, right, came out of the fact that, in order to provide some buffer around the COVID crisis and around the problems that the U.S. Postal Service has had in delivering things on time, that they would allow ballots that had been postmarked before Election Day, but not yet received, to be counted so long as they arrive by November 6th, right, 2 days from now, instead of having to arrive on Election Day itself, as was the case, for example, in Maine. That rule change was made through a court process rather than through a law passed by the Pennsylvania legislature, and that would be at issue. So, however, in Wisconsin, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court already decided that, in fact, late arriving ballots would not count. So there's probably not much of a case there. It's going to depend on the individual states. We should never forget that the American presidential election is actually 51 separate elections happening simultaneously under slightly different administrative rules. We're seeing that play out in real time now. There are a lot of votes out there to be counted. Pennsylvania didn't start counting its mail-in ballots in a number of counties until today. So it's all to play for. And so the armies of lawyers are ready to be deployed when they know exactly what there is to fight for.
All right. I want to just follow up really quickly and ask you both. I'll start with you, Dimitri. Do you foresee something that's the equivalent of the hanging chad of this year? Is it the signed envelope?
Sure, it could be, right? So, match signatures. The other case we've heard out of Pennsylvania was maybe some early canvassing where some voters were given a chance to correct their ballots, whether that's consistent with Pennsylvania law. Right. Again, I think we're right now talking about a very small number. The last number I saw was maybe 49 ballots may be affected. Right. But if it really does come down, look at the margins right now. Nevada is under 8,000 votes. Michigan's under 10,000 votes. So every ballot could make a difference. And that's where I think the army of lawyers comes in, whether it's looking for match signatures, whether it's, checking to make sure that the postmark is by yesterday, making sure that the ballot's properly sealed in the right envelope. You can always try to find some irregularities to latch onto, especially if you're behind by just a few hundred or a few thousand votes.
All right. Andrew, any thoughts to follow up on that?
No, I think that's right. And okay. It'll be a lot down to, individual state laws. And if we do get to a recount, then to individual ballots, conceivably.
Well, we still have so much more to talk about, for example, the Electoral College and the safe harbor deadline. But we do need to go to a quick break. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question, if you've been reading about all the potential scenarios out there now that the ballots have been cast, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Thomaston Place Auction Galleries, a Maine resource to families offering appraisal and auction services. Learn more at thomastonauction.com. Starfire Storage, offering transportation, handling, and storage of fine art collections. Details at starfire.me. And Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. deadriver.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It has been one of the most important elections in U.S. history.
So what happens now?
We'll look at the legal challenges and ask, will this nation heal?
All the latest. That's next time on Here and Now.
And Here and Now is coming up at 12 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
And And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, untangling the legal and constitutional issues associated with the election. Joining me, Andrew Rudalevich, who is chair of the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, where he's also the Thomas Brackett Reed Professor of Government, and Dimitri Baum, who is Vice Dean, Provost, and Professor of Law at the University of Maine School of Law. Share your comments or questions. Send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. Dimitri, I did something that I haven't done in a lot of decades, and reread the 12th Amendment this morning. It mentions electors and what they will do, but it doesn't mention how they are chosen. So walk us through a very basic understanding of who electors are and why they might matter this time. Why who they are matters this time.
Right. So I mean, this goes back to the founding era and the Electoral College scheme that was put in place by the drafters of the Constitution. Right. So original idea was that, the voters would vote for people that they know. These would be high-profile political figures in their state, people that they really trust to kind of go out and vote for the president. So that's what the ballots would actually look like. You would pick people from your community. You would trust to make the decision for you. And so that's who the electors are. Now, over the course of the years, we've transitioned to having the names of the presidents, presidential candidates, on the ballot. So we're voting for, Joe Biden, we're voting for President Trump. But the reality is it's the electors who will cast their votes for the candidates who supposedly receive the majority of the votes in the state. That's the theory behind it. Now, ultimately, state legislatures appoint the electors. But in today's kind of partisan system, it's a slate of electors selected by the party that won that state. And so, every state has its own set of electors. We've had over the years some faceless electors, electors who didn't vote for the person that won the majority in that state, but, generally it doesn't swing the election. Of course, if it's a, 270 to 269, 268 split at the end, every elector could make a difference. But these electors are selected by the party. And they're generally fairly safe votes that they will vote for the person that won that state.
All right. And a related question, I'll throw this to you, Andrew. Joshua on Facebook asks, regardless of the results today and over the next few days, is there any indication that any states may send electoral college electorates that do not vote with the popular vote in their state?
Yeah, this is something that has been worried about in the sense that, the Constitution vests the power to create a process for choosing electors in the legislature of a given state. And depending on how literally you take the word legislature, some would even argue that doesn't include the governor, it doesn't include anything else. And if you want to go even farther, you could argue that the election itself could be set aside. Again, a lot is going to depend on how the votes come in, what the margins look like, and whether there is a serious ground for contesting those results. Now, again, we started out talking about Bush v. Gore. Back in 2000, the Florida state government, which was a Republican majority at the time, indeed the governor was George W. Bush's brother, Jeb, did make noises about appointing an alternate set of electors, if the recount in Florida that year had not been halted, as it wound up being, by the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's not an impossibility, right? But it's pretty unlikely in that you would have to have a situation, again, that was so close that you could legitimately claim that the count did not represent the popular vote, right? All states require that the popular vote be reflected in the slate of electors that is sent. They vote, by the way, in mid-December. And so, there is some time to figure that out beforehand. Again, it's not impossible. I think it's unlikely, especially if projected results in some of the states that are still yet to declare work out the way they seem to be. But that, again, is that's an open question. And, nothing is settled yet. I do. Again, it would be it would be rare and unusual for a state legislature to act in that way.
All right. And Jennifer, a related question. Oh, go ahead, Dimitri.
I was going to jump in. This goes to a different provision of the U.S. Constitution as well, right? So Article 2, Section 1 is what says, you know, each state, in a manner as legislature provides, appoints the electors. And so that's the kind of where that potential concern comes in. You know, how literally do you read that provision? Is it entirely up to the legislature? Because that's the phrase that the Constitution uses. And as Andrew mentioned in Bush v. Gore, there was at least a concurrence. Three of the judges signed on to the theory that the legislature should have more of a say, or perhaps the final say, in how the electors are appointed, and maybe even all of the electoral rules, right? And so that's part of what the Pennsylvania case actually has underlying it. You know, as Andrew mentioned, it's the court that decided that the deadline should be moved to November 6th for the ballots that are postmarked by November 3rd, not the legislature. So it ties into a different provision of the Constitution.
And isn't part of this, Andrew, the idea that, or the fact that in some of these states, there's a governor of one party and a legislature represented in the majority by another party?
Yeah, well, that's the case in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, and I think Michigan as well. So you've got a, you know, if you think of the legislature as representing the normal legislative process, as I think we would consider that, you know, in sort of in normal discourse, then the governor obviously could veto that kind of action. Again, that wasn't going to happen in Florida in 2000. Given the circumstances, it probably would happen, you know, in Michigan or Pennsylvania or Wisconsin right now. But again, I don't want people to be doom scrolling even through their radio feed. It's, you know, we are some ways away from that. And, you know, the question about late arriving ballots in Pennsylvania only matters if those ballots are determinative in some way.
Okay. And an email from Jim. Andrew, you've mentioned a couple times the Bush v. Gore decision. An email from Jim. I think there was a specific statement in the Bush v. Gore decision saying that the decision was not precedent setting. Could your guest comment? Dimitri, is Jim right?
Yeah, so that was you know, one of the critiques of the case, that it was really kind of designed to be, you know, this ticket is for this train only, and it really can't cite it again. Now, when you look at the history of that case, that's generally been true. The court has not relied on it. You know, I think Justice Thomas cited it in a concurrence in one case after that, but it has not really been a precedent-setting case. But of course, you know, it's an unusual election, and we have another unusual, very close election. So, to the extent that we're talking about the Equal Protection Clause holding of that case, that you have to have the kind of same rules that apply throughout the state to all of the ballots counted, you can see that coming up, especially, as I mentioned earlier, the other Pennsylvania case, where maybe some counties started canvassing the ballots earlier and giving some voters a chance to cure their ballots, but not others. I think the court certainly could rely on that case. It's still binding precedent, and so it's up to the judges to decide how much weight they want to give to that equal protection rationale in any future case.
All right, we're going to go to Billy calling from Augusta. Hi, Billy, go ahead.
Yes, hi, thanks for taking my call. I'll make it short and sweet. One of the people on your panel, I think his name is Andrew, stated that the president said he wanted to stop the counting of the votes. That's not actually what the president said. The president actually said that he wanted the votes to stop. And I take that as exactly his verbiage, meaning that he doesn't want any late votes.
Andrew?
Well, I would say I think we can go back and look at the president's Twitter feed and the statement that he made overnight. You know, I think, but the basic point that that Billy's making there, I think, is right. You know, the idea is that votes that are legally received should be legally counted. I think the question will be what votes, you know, each campaign wants to consider legally counted. But I would say, you know, the election's over. Every vote has been cast. Obviously, you know, the argument is certainly not that votes should be counted outside of the state rules. But remember that the states have very different rules for when absentee ballots can be returned by mail. Washington State can receive them as late as, you know, 20 days after the election, and they are still counted under state law. You know, California, a few days before that. One reason that, you know, California elections take a while to settle. So, yeah, I mean, I think the question here is how late is being defined. And, you know, I think any vote that was cast, you know, in accordance with the rules of the state should be counted. I would have to disagree that the president was arguing for that, literally.
All right. Billy, thank you for your call. An email here from Carolyn. What would it take to elect a president by popular vote and have a uniform set of laws for federal elections? It seems that half of the state can be disenfranchised by the current system, except in Maine and New Hampshire. So, Dimitri, it actually sounds to me like Carolyn may be asking two different questions. One is, how could we have an election determined by popular vote? And also, how could we have the Electoral College system be more fair?
Yeah. Okay. So on the first question, the easy answer is it would take a constitutional amendment, right? So changing the constitution, the Electoral College is baked into the Constitution, and getting an amendment passed is not easy, right? We've only had 27 of them since the founding in the 1780s. It would require, most of Congress and most of the states, three quarters of the states, to agree on something. And when you look at the divide these days, that's almost impossible to imagine something like that happening, right? So even if in the abstract, behind a veil of ignorance, we might agree that Electoral College doesn't make much sense today, I think at any given time it benefits one party or the other, and right now it certainly benefits the Republican Party, and so there won't be agreement on that. There is a hope or a plan in place, an idea in place, that it could be done by agreement. So, states agree themselves that we will cast our electors in a way that the majority of the country has voted for. It would require the agreement of at least 270 electoral votes in the states. We've gotten close, but even there, it would require more states to join that compact. So there is this compact idea in place, and that's a possible way to do it. But really, I think a constitutional amendment is what's required. And as far as making the Electoral College process more fair, I think as the caller mentions, the Maine, the Nebraska way is one idea. Although from my understanding is if more states had gone in this direction, we still would have the splits, even worse splits, between the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. So I don't think adopting the Maine-Nebraska approach would necessarily guarantee that the Electoral College vote would line up with the popular vote.
I'm going to toss to you, but I'm going to throw in a tweet in between. Marfine says that he would like to see the Electoral College abolished, and wondering what the paths to doing that and what are the thoughts of your likelihood of that happening. So let's keep talking about the Electoral College, Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, well, the likelihood is slim because, again, the constitutional amendment is an arduous process, and the Electoral College does overweight some states, and those states you have to think would be a little reluctant to change it. I'm also a little bit leery about the district-based system. Even in Maine. And it looks like, as we heard at the top of the hour, that it looks like President Trump will win the second district, win an electoral vote. Former Vice President Biden seems to have won an electoral vote in Nebraska, so I guess they'll kind of cancel each other out. But remember, if we do this by congressional district, we're merely replicating the geographic bias of congressional districts. On another show, we might spend an hour discussing gerrymandering and the ways in which congressional districts are drawn specifically to benefit one party. Well, that would just be replicated in the Electoral College if we were to use a district system. So I'm a little, leery about moving to that system. One other option, of course, would be that, we might wind up with more elections not resulting in a majority of the Electoral College and therefore moving to the House of Representatives, which I suspect people wouldn't love either. So I think unless you go to a national popular vote system, preferably by constitutional amendment, it's going to be very hard to make those things line up. I mean, it does look like Joe Biden is ahead by, 2.5 million votes or so, at the national level. Again, could still win the Electoral College. But if he doesn't, I expect this debate to rekindle. Just one very quick addition, though. Remember that if you had a national popular vote system, unless you have something like a runoff or ranked choice voting, you could wind up with quite a number of candidates running, in a plurality system would then elect a president who might have far less than 50% of the popular vote, which is, again, not what that reform is aiming for. So I think you have to be worried about unintended consequences.
All right. Well, we are going to take another quick break. If you have a question about what the law, what the Constitution says about the presidential election, what might happen next, you can give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Of course, our email address, talk@mainpublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bristol Seafood's My Fish Dish. Garlic and herb, butter, shrimp, and three other varieties. Found in the freezer at your local Hannaford. Marshall Communications, with Nancy Marshall's The PR Maven podcast, offering advice on building your brand and network. MarshallPR.com. And Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at BullMoose.com.
Author Heister Richard Hornberger Jr. died in Portland on November 4, 1997. Hornberger was an American writer and surgeon who wrote under the pseudonym Richard Hooker. Hornberger's best-known work was his novel MASH, written in 1968, based on his harrowing drama and comedic experiences as a wartime Army surgeon doctor during the Korean War and written in collaboration with W.C. Hines. It was used as the basis for an award-winning, critically and commercially successful movie, MASH, in 1970, and 2 years later in an acclaimed long-running television series of the same name. After the success of his book and its screen adaptations, Hornberger continued to practice as a surgeon in Waterville until his retirement in 1988.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher and Maine Masons, celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine! With COVID-19 cases on the rise here in Maine, the Maine CDC has scheduled a briefing for later today, this afternoon at 2. Our plan at this time is to take a break from election returns and analysis to bring you the briefing. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw at 2 o'clock this afternoon will be carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you are listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're talking about the aftermath of the election from a legal, constitutional point of view. Our guests are Dimitri Baum, constitutional scholar with the UMaine School of Law, and Andrew Rudalevich, government professor with Bowdoin College. If you'd like to join our conversation, you have time to send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page if you hurry, or you can call 1-800-399-3566. I want to talk to you all about the safe harbor deadline, which my understanding is December 8th. By December 8th, all election disputes must be settled. Dimitri, is this a date that means anything? Andrew, I believe, said that Washington State gives up to 20 days to count ballots. Is it possible that by December 8th we won't know?
I mean, it's possible. And certainly, you know, San Bush v. Gore, we're getting close to that deadline, which was kind of part of what was driving the court's decision there. You know, I think where we are today, I think it's highly unlikely that even if we're looking at some of the later arriving ballots, all of the counting should be done by then, and the court challenges can be decided fairly quickly. So there's certainly nothing unusual about waiting for a few days to count the ballots, and it's too early to worry about the December 8th deadline.
Okay. Andrew?
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, I mean, so the safe harbor deadline is does not, unfortunately, I guess, end all disputes. It first requires that the state has some kind of consistent procedure to settle any kind of controversies or contests over electors and their electoral votes. So they first have to have a clear process, and then secondly, they have to apply it. And if they've done so, then the safe harbor effectively protects that decision from later second guessing by Congress or the courts. But remember, the Congress is actually the body that accepts the electoral votes ultimately in early January 2021. It will be the new Congress. We don't know quite how different that will look from the current Congress. but they are the counters of the vote. There's an Electoral Count Act that was passed in the 19th century and has been very occasionally revised. It's not nearly as clear as we might like it to be in the case of really serious disputes. But, you know, it's conceivable, right? And we talked earlier about the possibility of, you know, again, let's pick on Pennsylvania, them sending, you know, a slate of electors to Congress. It's conceivable that the governor could certify a different slate of electors. And then, you know, Congress effectively has to choose between the two. You know, that hasn't happened often, thank goodness. 1876, if we want to go down a historical rabbit hole, was an example of an election that was so hugely contested that Congress actually created a commission to try to settle all of the competing slates of electors that had been sent.
All right. And also reading that 12th Amendment says that if the House doesn't select a president by March 4th, the vice president becomes president. Dimitri,
well,
I'm guessing
January
you're going to...
January 20th now, by the way.
Oh, it's what now?
Well, that was shifted to January 20th by the 20th Amendment.
Oh, gosh, that's what happens when I don't read all my amendments, I guess. Okay, so January 20th is the date. So we're going to go to Deirdre, who's calling from South Portland. Hi, Deirdre, go ahead.
Hi. I was calling because I wasn't certain if everybody knew, but I thought it was important to know that Amy Coney Barrett and Kavanaugh and I believe Neil Gorsuch were all lawyers that were sent by the Republican Party to Florida to help get Bush elected through the case that went to the Supreme Court. So that if this election goes to the Supreme Court, at least two and I think three of the justices are actually ex-Republican lawyers who helped get Bush elected through the Supreme Court in
his
first election.
Yeah. Interesting. Dimitri?
Yeah, I mean, what I'd say about that is, you know, the path to the Supreme Court these days, and it requires you know, political connections, and so we see that with Justice Roberts as well. You know, many of the appointees to the Supreme Court had been involved with the political party, were high profile figures in the political party, and they're political figures. They have political and partisan views. You know, there have certainly been challenges to whether or not there's, you know, recusal required by Justice Barrett because she was just recently appointed, and President Trump has made it very clear that he hopes she and her colleagues would cast the deciding vote in one of these cases. So it's not surprising that you know, the Republican appointed justices were, you know, involved in Republican politics, and the same would be true of Democratic appointed justices.
And to your point, Dimitri, I know that Senator Angus King has called on Amy Coney Barrett to recuse herself if such a case comes to the Supreme Court. I believe, Andrew, she did not answer that question.
Yeah, and she's not. There's not really a you know, any kind of clear guideline other than the justice's conscience as to when or how they should recuse. Now, she might be wise to do so in order to try to spare the legitimacy of the court, because there will clearly be questions about, you know, any decision they make. But Dimitri is right, right? The way that justices are chosen in the modern era is really on the grounds of their having been active in party politics at some point. You know, we hope that the court won't be partisan, but I don't think we can expect that it won't be political.
All right, Deirdre, thanks for your call. I'll go to this question from Eva. I'm wondering why we have a two-party system when almost every leading democracy in the modern world follows a multi-party system. It seems that many of our problems are rooted with this problem. Andrew?
Okay. Well, again, we're back to the structure of the Constitution and the winner-take-all process by which we elect people. And that doesn't eliminate third parties, right? There were five parties technically on the presidential ballot in Maine yesterday, and four, of course, on the Senate side. But, you know, a winner-take-all election, as opposed to proportional representation, requires, or I guess doesn't require, but it encourages voters, you know, not to waste a vote, right, on somebody who can't win, and it tends to make third parties far less significant. So in countries where there's proportional representation in the legislature, normally based on, you know, the percentage of votes that that party gets nationally. Sometimes there's other means of counting it up. You know, they do tend to have third parties, but they also often, I think almost always, have prime ministers, right, who come out of a coalition of those parties rather than being separately elected. So we have a presidential system. We have a congressional system where, again, it's a sort of first-past-the-post winner, except in a place like Maine where we have ranked choice voting. And, you know, that system is really grounded in the structure of the Constitution. So to move to a system where third parties had more sway, again, you're talking about a pretty fundamental reform.
All right. A question here from Ray. When do military ballots get counted? Do either of you know?
They get counted when they arrive. And again, the rules of the state dictate how that happens. That was yet another argument in Florida in 2000. But certainly, you know, military ballots, because they're almost by definition from overseas, usually come in after Election Day. And so, you know, and we want, obviously, those who are serving abroad to be able to vote. Again, it will vary by state in terms of the actual rules.
And that's an important theme that, you know, Andrew has mentioned a few times here, that, you know, many of these election rules are state rules. Obviously, there's kind of a national level oversight, and there's some provisions in the Constitution. But a lot of the decisions about which ballots to count and when are left up to the states, which is why you have this kind of a patchwork quilt of different rules, with, you know, very different deadlines, very different processes, which leads to these armies of lawyers going to different places.
Let me ask you about this. A lot has been said about the one of the candidates or another conceding the election, that it's been brought up that this is what we do in the United States, is that somebody concedes. Dimitri, is there a constitutional basis for this idea of somebody conceding and then what follows? Or is this grown out of tradition?
I think it's more of a tradition in history of this nation that we have kind of a smooth transitions of power and people concede when they've lost. We've seen even in close elections, we look at the 2000 election when Al Gore, you know, could have continued arguing and fighting and trying to challenge the Supreme Court's ruling, but he conceded for the benefit of the nation. So that's a tradition. Now, the constitutional reality is, you know, at some point, a president must be chosen by the electors and take place in the White House. And so, you know, at that point, if the president, President Trump, refuses to leave, then you have a true constitutional crisis about, okay, what happens next? Who's in charge of the military? can you get President Trump out of office? But, you know, a concession speech is certainly not required by the Constitution.
Sure. And Andrew, there's a tweet about that. What happens if Trump does not want to go peacefully? What is in place to ensure a peaceful transition?
Well, we mentioned the 20th Amendment. The 20th Amendment says that the office of president and vice president are vacant as of noon on January 20th. And so if there's been no decision by that point, well, presumably the Succession Act would kick in, and I guess that would mean that the Speaker of the House would be the president, at least for that moment. Again, there's a lot of room before that. It is true that the tradition is to concede. You know, he'd Dimitri mentioned 2000. We could look at 1960, when Richard Nixon, not exactly remembered as a figure of gracious civic pride, you know, did in fact step away after the 1960 election, which was remarkably close, very contested, a couple of states. You know, there were legitimate arguments that there had been some vote fraud that could have helped the Republican ticket. Nixon conceded to Kennedy largely on the grounds, again, that it was the right thing for the country. I guess the issue this year is that both sides are so convinced that the other side winning is a disaster for the country, and that therefore what is good for the country is for them to win. You know, it's that I fear, I guess, if this continues to play out, you know, not over the next few days, but if we wind up in a situation where the result is tainted or can be painted as illegitimate.
All right. And to how bright our listeners are, an email from Jim: isn't the Speaker of the House, isn't it the Speaker of the House in case we get to January 20th? And Andrew, that's your point. You don't think we're going to get today at January 20th, but yes, Jim is correct in that case. We're going to go to Constantino calling from Westbrook. We were talking about conceding. And Constantino, I understand you have something to add to that part of the conversation.
Yes, the tradition of concession started in 1896 when William Jennings Bryan conceded to McKinley.
All right, there we go. Thank you, Andrew.
There you go. No, well, that I'm willing to believe that. Obviously, in terms in practical terms, I guess it starts in 1800 when Thomas Jefferson defeats John Adams for re-election. And Adams, you know, no fan of Jefferson at that time, though they became friends again later. But again, understood the will of the Republic and stepped aside.
Well, right, even the 1876 election that you mentioned, Andrew, you know, obviously it was a little bit different, but there you had the potential competing slates, and yet there was a compromise and agreement reached by the parties that we're going to settle this. We all get something in exchange, but we will concede that we count one slate for President Hayes instead of Tilden, who was very close to that election, and there's like some arguments that he could have had enough votes.
Yeah, well, I only have to append to that the deal that was cut, of course, withdrew Union troops from the South after 1876, and arguably a not so great compromise for the point of view of African Americans living below the Mason-Dixon line.
We have about a minute left. I'm going to ask you both very quickly to do something I suspect you are a little uncomfortable doing, but I'm going to make you predict. Dimitri, what do you think is going to happen this week?
Well, that's tough to do. I know on Monday night I had a kind of a long, restless night as I was thinking of the worst possible scenarios of what could happen, violence in the streets. It hasn't planned out. It hasn't panned out that way. And so I guess I'm more optimistic today that as we get all the counts from the outstanding states, we actually will get a resolution. I mean, right now it looks like Vice President Biden's ahead in Michigan and Wisconsin and Nevada, which would give him enough votes. But either way, I think once the votes are counted, there may be enough to maybe negate any Supreme Court challenges.
All right. And Andrew, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, all we can do right now is go with the data, and the data only suggests, right, that Vice President Biden will be able to pull out narrow victories in some of the states that President Trump won last time. Well, if we don't have to go to Pennsylvania, so much the better.
Well, it is such a privilege to have you both on today. I know you probably didn't get a lot of sleep last night. Andrew Rudalevich, Chair of the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, and Dimitri Baum, Vice Dean, Provost, and Professor at the University of Maine School of Law. Stay with Maine Public throughout the day and into the night with special election coverage and any results as they come in on radio, television, and at mainepublic.org. Today's sound engineer, Lucy Suchek. Our producers, Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.